Hi, I'm Taylor Smurl.
And I'm Liz June.
And this is...
Neat!
It's a weekly boozecast.
It's a history lesson with a twist.
All right. Well, it's officially spooky times.
It is.
We are into October. Have you done anything spooky this week, Liz?
Have I done anything spooky? I lit some candles.
Nice.
I've been kind of scaring myself by one of your recommendations for what to watch was Ratched, which looks really amazing, but I have been trying to work up the courage all week to start it because I watched the trailer and saw that it was about lobotomies. Mm-hmm. And there are very few things that are cringy for me, and lobotomies is one of them. And it's really scary to me.
You know, I will say it's not entirely about lobotomies. They kind of move past the lobotomy plot point fairly quickly. But I also do want to say, because look, Ratched is beautiful, like color toned, fashion, like fantastic trash. It is. So anybody that's judging me on my recommendation, that's fair. But I did really enjoy it. And if you're afraid of lobotomies, I mean, they're there, but they're not like, it's like 15% lobotomies.
Okay. So I could get past the lobotomy part and then be like, I could just like close my eyes for those parts.
Yeah. There's worse things than lobotomies that happen in Ratched. But if that's just your thing, like whatever else is fine, but just not that. No ice pick to the eye socket. There's only a little bit of that. I think that there are two. Are there two? Okay. I think there are two actual lobotomies in the show.
Okay. They're not surprise lobotomies, right? if I knew that they're coming up.
You get build up to it. You know what's coming. I don't know how you could do it. I guess a surprise lobotomy would require like a precision, sort of a sharpshooter, a very specific kind.
It's
not something you could not train somebody for, but that's not covered in Ratched. Okay. It's mainly just Sarah Paulson being a very spooky lesbian in very beautiful outfits.
All right. Okay. I think I could. Okay. I'm going to do it this week. I'm going to work up the courage.
I mean, it's like if you don't like American Horror Story, then you will not like Ratched. If you like American Horror Story, then you will like Ratched. That is how I'd sell it.
Okay. All right. Okay. I'm getting back on the train.
Yeah.
I'll do it this week. I'm going to watch it. I gotta do it.
Watch like an episode, you know, like watch like one or two, and you'll know, because it's. I mean, to me, I have to be honest. Like, I thought like a lot of Ryan Murphy things. There's a story. It's like it's all right, but this is like the fashion and the style, the color palette of the show, the shots, like the visuals of it are just like a feast, just a big gay, beautiful, creepy feast for me, and I love that.
Awesome. How have you done anything spooky? I think. There's Inktober, right? Have you started Inktober?
You know, Inktober is interesting. I haven't done it this year. I've been focusing on like bigger projects because I feel like every Inktober I get to the end of it and I've rushed through trying to put out drawings that I don't really have anything to do with. Like I just did them to say I did them and I'm never particularly happy with them. Right. And
well, you do spooky stuff. You do spooky drawings all the time.
Yeah, I mean, all the drawings I've done are still spooky. Doing it.
Yeah,
yeah. There's also like the dude that started Inktober like trademarked it, so you can't actually like put out your Inktober sketchbook anymore without him. Like, and he released an art book that stole heavily from another art book that was done by a person of color. So that's no bueno.
Oh my god!
So I don't necessarily want to support the concept of Inktober. for me personally. If you are, okay, that's fine. It's a great drawing exercise, but you know, I had reasons not to.
I have not started because I am intimidated by deadlines, so I didn't even begin it, and now I'm not going to.
Well, you know, so
thank you for letting me know that.
The concept of taking a month to give yourself challenges artistically is great, but I think basing those challenges off of how you make art is such a smarter idea. Like, I am not somebody that, like, just, like, I don't work in traditional mediums. All of my drawing is usually on the computer, so, like, I don't, like, I'm switching mediums to one that I don't really use nor try to use, and, like, it's not really, I usually spend a lot of time on pieces, but they're bigger pieces. So I think, like, you know, if you want to say my Inktober goal is that I'm going to do 3 finished drawings and they're going to take a little longer, or I'm going to do 1 piece. Like, I think that's fine. I think it's great to have, like, a goal. But the idea of like 31 finished ink drawings, if that's what you work in, if that's your medium and that's your style, like, that's great. It's a great exercise. But I don't know. I think it's better to, like, kind of treat it. It's, you know, in the artistic community, a lot of people are doing stuff around it. Super good. But you can treat it with, like, however fits, like, the way you work.
I like that. That's cool.
Oh. So I have Inktober goals, but they are not an ink drawing every day.
Okay. Cool. I'm excited to see those.
Yes.
You've been doing lots of spooky stuff.
Yeah, and all of the entire Patreon rewards. Even though the previous month was not a spooky month, you're still getting nothing but spooky Patreon rewards in the mail. So I hope everyone's okay with a little bit of spooky content.
I think so.
Yeah. But you know, it's not just spooky time, it's fall time. We have a really good good topic today that is very fall appropriate. This was inspired by a question asked by a listener named Sarah. Asked this question a couple Patreon asks ago, I think. Maybe 2. But the question was about something called Pomo. That they'd got at their local cidery. And what is it and how to drink it? And we want to answer that question, but that question actually requires us talking about something else entirely.
What is the precursor to Pomo? What do we need to know before we dive into Pomo?
Well, so Pomo has 2 essential ingredients in it, and one of those is Calvados, and we have not talked about Calvados on this show before. So I thought we're gonna answer Sarah's question, we're gonna get into Pomo, but before that, we're gonna give you a little primer on Calvados.
Okay, what is Calvados, Taylor?
Well, Calvados is, simply put, it's a brandy made from mainly apples, and it originates in Normandy, France. Now, how it's made, so first you need apples. There are over 200 varietals of apples that actually go into Calvados production, and they're selected for their range of flavors, acidity, sweetness, bitterness. Basically, like, they've designed a flavor profile for Calvados, right? Like 70% of the blend of the apple juice that goes into making Calvados is pulled from the bitter and bittersweet apples, and then 30% of that flavor profile comes from sweet and acidic apples. It's not like all 200 varieties end up in every bottle of Calvados, but this is the range of apples that you pull from to get that balance. Now, within that sweet component, within that 30%, you can use some pears. So that's why I say mainly apples. Oh. Yes. Pears are allowed. They just must not be highlighted.
Okay.
Yeah. From there, you take those apples and maybe pears, and you press them into cider. That cider is going to be fermented and distilled into an eau de vie, you know, basically just an unaged fruit-based spirit. And that eau de vie is going to be aged for at least 2 years before it can be sold as what is known as Calvados. There are a bit more categories inside that definition, or appellations, more correctly, that will inform you a bit more about what's going on in the particular bottle you come across. Now, I'm going to use the acronym AOC.
AOC!
not referring to our beloved congresswoman, but it's, you know, not, I mean, I was going to say not quite as good. And I guess I'll stand by that fact. But what that, it's basically, it's, oh, I'm going to attempt French.
I spelled it phonetically.
Do you want to do it? You typically have better luck.
I think it's Appellation d'Origine Contrôlée.
That sounded great. Kind of. Yes, that sounded better than I would have done. And what that translates to is the controlled designation of origin. AOC, it's not just it came from here. It also means it came from here and it was made in this way. And it's okay. In France, it's not just used for spirits. It's used for wine. It's used for cheese. Lots of other agricultural products get recognized with AOCs. And it's just like a stamp of like integrity to them. Like, we can guarantee you that it has this composition of the flavor varietals. It's made in these ways, and it comes from these regions. I appreciate those. You know, we have something similar like with like the bourbon laws in America, but it's that's one of the few areas that we hyper legislate. Like, most things, it's kind of a free for all. And I actually really like when you can just look at certain words on a bottle and be like, okay, I know what's in here. So the AOC definitions, they date back to the 15th century in France. The first thing was actually Roquefort blue cheese that got a appellation. But speaking of Calvados, there are three that are designated. The first and the most common is just AOC Calvados. That covers like 70-75% of most Calvados on the market. That is distilled once. It can be distilled twice, but traditionally it's distilled once in a column still. It's aged for a minimum of 2 years on oak, and it has a wider but still very limited region of production. So it's still restricted to certain areas, and it's still highly regulated. But it's still the one that's like it's the cheapest to be made. It's the loosest regulations of the three. AOC Domfonte, that sound right?
Yeah, that's I don't think I could do better.
All right,
there's gonna be a lot. I feel like we should.
I'm sorry.
There's gonna be a lot of French on this episode.
Yes,
and we're gonna try our best.
I'm very sorry to any French speaking listeners. We are doing our best. You just have a very beautiful language that, so unfortunately, beautiful. Our stumbly American tongues aren't very good with dealing with. but yes, so
but AOC. I think that's pretty close.
Yeah, all right. AOC Domfonte is the one that this one includes 30% pear. So this is where you find your pear Calvados. And also has designated growing areas. It's also distilled once using column stills, and this one's aged a little longer. It's aged for a minimum 3 years on oak. So it has a different composition. It includes those pears, and it's aged a little longer. Now, the one that's considered the best and the highest quality, I should have written down the pronunciation here.
It looks like Pays. It's Pays d'Auge.
Pays d'Auge. Oh.
D'Auge. Yeah.
Pays d'Auge. Thank you. Okay. is AOC Calvados Pays d'Auge. Maybe?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
I think so. Yeah.
So now this one has the cider first. So you press that juice and you let that cider ferment for a minimum of 6 weeks. It has to be double distilled, and it uses an alembic pot still. That's the same pot still that's used for cognac, which creates a completely different, way more fruit-forward flavor. And it's aged for a minimum of 2 years in oak casks. There's an argument, like, I think, not an argument, there's a contemplation of which style produces the better Calvados. With the pot still, you, like I said, you get something fruitier, something a little softer and sweeter. With the column still, you get something that people say is more complex, but I think that the final weigh-in comes from master distillers that say, I can get complexity or fruitiness from either still. It just depends on the, you know, this is just the method you choose.
Okay.
It's worth mentioning, though. There, like, within these three categories, there's something you'll come across, which is Fermier Calvados or farm-made. But that just refers to it being made entirely in the traditional way, and it can exist in all of these all of these categories. So it's cool. Sort of a micro category. Now, I will just some common things that we think about when we're talking about distilling and aging spirits. I mentioned oak for all three of these, and that is true. They all utilize oak barrels, oak casks, but there is some finesse here because it does not legislate whether it has to be new or aged oak. So they can use some new oak, they can use some old oak, they can use some oak that has held other spirits. That is fine. Ooh. And most Calvados is produced in a blend of, like, it'll sit a year on new oak and a year on old oak, or, you know, whatever. Yeah. Whatever. And also, much like cognac, the label also will further note how long it's aged. Like, you know, it's the same kind of language you're used to with cognac. Like, reserve is 3 years. VSOP is 4. Extra or Napoleon means 6 or more. But that any age statement on a bottle of Calvados refers to the youngest Calvado in that bottle. It's not the oldest. So you might get some older Calvados in the mix. But
okay.
Yeah. So it's more of like a statement of quality again. Like, you're not getting anything younger than 4 years on this bottle. You're not getting anything younger than 3 years on this bottle.
Nice. So, yeah, so that's kind good
of,
to know.
You know, it could be a bit of a confusing label there, but it's all just different statements of quality. You know, if you get something that is any of the AOCs, you sort of know that it's been signed off on, and, you know, like, how it's made, what's gone into it, and also what hasn't gone into it, which I think is really cool.
That is awesome.
So there you go.
Cool. Yeah.
But why don't you give us some... Where did this come from?
Well, that's a good question, because... So it's not only, like, this spirit is named Calvados, but actually also the region is called Calvados, or Department. The Department of... that sounds stupid when I say department. I have to say the French way. Département of Calvados is a zone within Normandy. And that area was created and established with the French Revolution. But although that is true, the Eau de Vie de Cidre was already a thing for a long time. Mainly recognized as a farmer's drink, but that was definitely referred to as Calvados by the population around there. And, you know, we could definitely get into how we got cider. Actually, do you want to talk a little bit about how cider got to Normandy? Because I think you have some of that.
Well, yeah, so... I mean, obviously, like, you know, cider, necessary step in Calvados. And, I mean, we have evidence of cider being brewed, in Normandy, like, as early as the 8th century. Like, at that point, we were cultivating orchards and we had brewing knowledge. The Norman Vikings in, like, the 10th century were drinking cider. And it was kind of in the 15th century that cider got into the hands and got popular with the aristocracy and the clergy. And we all know what happens when the clergy gets involved. Shit gets distilled.
They said, we need this to be stronger. Well, yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's how all the cider orchards were already there. And there were farmers there making something similar to what we know as Calvados, but not exactly, but they were definitely calling it Calvados. The first known record of it being distilled and referred to, like you said, was in the 1500s, and that was made by Giles Picot, Lord of Gooberville, which I only mentioned
because... That sounds like a bad nickname.
Yeah, well, no, it's his official title, so I'm sure he's very proud. I'm sure he was very proud to be the Lord of Gooberville.
Does that mean something in French that means something different than what it means in English?
Gooberville.
Okay, that sounds sexy. You say anything with a French accent and it's 10 times better.
I mean, I tried to make Gooberville sexy.
Oh, Gooberville.
But so Giles was responsible for recording it, and then about 50 years later, in 1606, an official guild for cider distillation was created. Fancy. By the 17th century, many cider farms were further developed in Normandy, and farmers began to really produce their own Calvados according to what it was recorded as to be. And then thanks to the French Revolution, the product exchange was liberalized. So they were allowed to basically free trade, not taxed. And then thanks to the region of Calvados, close proximity to Paris, it became very popular. And then in the 19th century, we have more industry coming in, and we have industrial distillation, which means that they can have greater production, which comes just in time for the wine plague.
Just in time.
Just in time. So there was phylloxera. I think that's how it's said. It's a phylloxera outbreak. It's like a disease for the vines.
Right.
Right. Okay, cool. Just checking.
I would do no better. I think that sounds great.
It's a vine disease. you know, apples aren't affected by a vine disease. So Calvados kind of has a bit of a golden age. And one of the ways that they actually liked to drink it was called Café Calva, which is very simply just a cup of coffee with a teaspoon of Calvados poured on top. And that sounds very lovely, I have to say. That sounds great.
Very good.
Yeah.
I like that it was kind of like, that was a working class beverage. Like just a little coffee with a little nip. Like that's, that works.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, like, the research I stumbled into talking about Café Calva was saying basically that at the time the Calvados was about the same price as the coffee, so just putting a little bit on top was like it wasn't considered like we're making this fancy. It was just like, oh yeah, just put a little brandy on top. Like I think that speaks more to coffee being expensive at that time than brandy being inexpensive.
That makes sense.
Yeah. I don't know. That's just speculation, but I think it's fair to say. But it also had a supporting role in several wars, because war's going on and booze is always involved somehow. So in Napoleon's navy, Calvados was used as both an anesthetic and an antiseptic, which sounds pretty rough. That does not sound like a good treatment of either of those things. If you need to knock you out drinking out. Well, I mean, I guess it was that's popular to like at the time when they didn't have anesthesia to just drink some brandy, but doesn't seem like it would be that effective. And especially as an antiseptic, I think it would be rather sticky.
I don't know how effective that would be, but you know,
I don't know, but it might make you feel better. I don't know.
It might numb the wound, maybe. It depends on how strong it was.
Yeah, I guess.
Is this before or after we had the ability to measure alcohol content? Maybe it was clean. Who knows?
Yeah, no, you're right. It might have been higher then, but and then in World War I, cider brandy was requisitioned by the government, which basically means the government's like, hey, you have to make this for me. Yeah. And so that they could make alcohol for the armament industry, the weapons. They needed the alcohol for the weapons. So there was a lot of production for those cider brandy producers, but not a lot of quality going on. But that used to happen a lot. Fortunately for them, in 1942, there was a decree that recognized the Calvados Pays d'Auge as certified designation of origin, and that protected it from war requisitions. Yay! And then all the other Appalachians received this protection by 1997. So now none of them ever have to make alcohol for war again.
I like that designation being made, because that's not a, I don't know, we usually lose our alcohol culture during wartime. I mean, for justifiable reasons, but I like that. Like, no. Mm. When we come back, we want good Calvados.
Yeah. We don't want to lose this again. Okay. We worked very hard to make it what it is. We're not starting from scratch. We're not doing it. And I mentioned one way that they drink Calvados, which sounds very good, but are there other ways? Are there better ways?
With Calvados, as far as traditionally how it's consumed, it's usually consumed either straight or on the rocks. It's, you know, something that would be had out of a snifter or a balloon glass. It is a versatile and delicious base spirit that, obviously over on the video, I'll give you some fun, creative cocktails to make. But, one way that traditionally it's kind of a time period in which it's enjoyed and less of a cocktail structure is something called the, Littoral Normand, or the Normand Hole. That's just more during a multi-course meal. You would have some Calvados cut with possibly some sorbet, some apple or pear sorbet. And that would just sort of keep your appetite rolling while you wait for your next course. So once again, a very simple preparation, and more of a, less of a structure and more of just a tradition. I think this is a great moment to transition to another great way of enjoying Calvados, which is, to go back to our original question, Pomo. Pomo involves Calvados. In a way, it's sort of a bottled Calvados cocktail, if you will. And I think it's the simplest, like, most readily available way of enjoying Calvados.
Yes.
So I guess this is also still me. Cool. All right.
Sorry.
No, it's fine. I just feel bad talking in a wall.
I would like to, I would love some more information about how does this blend happen? What's going on here?
Well, so Pomo, traditionally, it's like the fruitiest cider apple juice would be cut with cider brandy to preserve their flavor, just make it a longer shelf life. This tradition, it's in its modern incarnation, has a bit stricter definition. It's you mix 2/3 of apple must or unfermented apple juice to 1/3 of year-old Calvados, so slightly younger than the Calvados that we get in the bottle. The proportions are chosen to ensure that the end product has like a 16-18% alcohol content. And then that mixture is put into a vat. It's mixed, then it's moved to oak barrels, and it's left to age for around 30 months. So the resulting product, you get this nice merger that's very, it's mellow, it's very like smooth, it has a lot of really beautiful fruity qualities, but it also has a lot of like those roasty vanilla notes and tannins from the barrel. And it's, like I said, it literally comes out as just, you can use it as a mixer, but you can also just put it on ice and just drink it straight, because it's done all the work for you. Yeah, it's like it's just take really good juice and a really good base, mix them, age them, pour them in a glass. And unlike, you know, we've been talking about Calvados, which is restricted to territories within Normandy, but Pomo can be made in a couple places, so it's a little bit of a shiftier designation in that there are appellations connected to Pomo, but the process itself is a little bit looser, a little bit less regulated. So basically, it is fresh juice cut with fresh cider brandy, and it also has a history, which I think you know some more about than I do.
Yeah, I mean, like our favorite spirits, aperitifs, what have you, it kind of happened a little bit by accident on purpose, but you know, but it wasn't really official until pretty recently. So the tradition of making pommeau did start, as you mentioned, with farmers, French apple farmers would take their fruitiest cider apple juices and some cider brandy, add some to preserve it. And the product, the result is pretty much essentially an aperitif. So farmers in these regions have been doing this for a long time without really making any noise about it. But then in the 1970s, some of the producers got together to create a more uniform method, and they promoted it as pommeau de Normandie, but couldn't officially sell it because it wasn't like approved to be a product until 1981, when it was officially granted dispensation. And then following that, the Association Nationale Interprofessionnelle des Producteurs de Pommeau, which is shortened to ANIPP, that was set up the following year. So there's an official association. Yep. Yeah. and like you mentioned, there's three Appalachians. Wait, what am I? Appalachians. Appalachians? No.
Appalachians is me.
There are three Appalachians, Pommeau, you know what? I'm not going to try to, you know what? It's Brittany, Normandy, and Maine in France. But Pommeau was granted its own AOC in 1991. So pretty recent stuff. And like you mentioned, the regulations are not as strict as far as calling something Pommeau, because you don't have to use Calvados. You can use cider brandy, which means that you can make it outside of France even. There's mm-hmm. There's a trend in the United States, especially like upstate New York, there's a lot of cider farms who are starting to make their own Pommeau that understandably tastes a lot different from the Pommeaus of Normandy and France in general. And that's going to be largely in part to the environment that the apples are raised in. It has a lot to do with that.
Well, that is definitely like, when we're dealing with a lot of these AOCs from France, you can do the same thing in other parts of the world. You just can't call it the same thing. Like champagne. Mm. There are plenty of places around the world that make something on level with champagne that cannot be called champagne, but it's made in the same way. It's made from similar grapes. It comes out as a very similar quality product. And so arguably you could make a Calvados or a Pommeau, call it something different and have it be the same. But I do think it is interesting because we have in America, obviously we have Applejack, which is our own style apple brandy. And that's usually like these companies that make a Pommeau are also known for their Applejack, which is distilled in a different way. It's got its own style. So, you know, it's not that you couldn't get a Pommeau that tastes like a French Pommeau in America. It's just, we have our own apple history here.
Yeah, they want to do their own thing. Yeah, they don't have to be like the French.
If they want to, that's fine.
They could. Yeah, they could.
Yeah, it's just a designation of where it's coming from and how it's made. But that could be replicated anywhere else in the world, and it could still taste similarly. It just can't get that same labeling.
Yeah. Pommeau's not as uptight as Calvados, and as far as people replicating it, you can do a lot. There's a little bit more of a workaround there.
I think that's a fair representation. I mean, because it keeps even in Pommeau made in France, it's not just made in places where you just can make Calvados. So,
mm-hmm. It's lovely.
When it comes to how to drink Pommeau, I will absolutely give you a cocktail on the video, but I do want to lead with, if you have some or you come across some, and if you're an old-fashioned drinker or a Manhattan drinker, just put it on the rocks.
Just like, literally.
Maybe throw a bitter in there if you feel like you want a little bit of something.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Yeah, like maybe an orange twist, but it's a little like rock and rye, if anybody's had that. Like, it's a lot like it's literally, to me, just tastes like a beautiful bottled cocktail that you could just put over ice and Like if you love the concept of a fall cocktail, but you don't want the work of a fall cocktail, track down a bottle of Pummo.
It's done. It's like I'm done.
Yeah.
Just drink me.
It's there for
you. Gorgeous.
Yeah.
Does it? Is there like a traditional way of drinking Pummo? Besides just drink it?
I mean, that's what it seems like. The answer is just it's not often. I mean, it's usually consumed as an aperitif. So it's in that same category of, like, you know, when we say aperitif, it's something usually on the sweet side you consume before a meal to kind of awaken your taste buds, your senses. yeah, so, I mean, I'll work it into a cocktail because that's what I do. But I think also, you know, traditionally, both of these spirits are things that are consumed happily on their own, maybe on some ice, but not even that.
Maybe paired with some rich food or some dessert.
Yeah. Ooh. Well, there's a lot of calvados and ice cream situations that are out there in the culinary world.
Yes.
Makes total sense. I feel kind of, I mean, you know, I one thing I love about this podcast is I'm always learning and, you know, I've always thought of not Applejack and calvados as interchangeable, but I've never really taken the time to compare them. And actually, from doing like the two episodes and then trying the two spirits, like, oh, these are completely different. Like calvados,
yeah.
I don't want to say it's sweet, but it just has more residual sugar, I think. It just has like it has a different viscosity to it than Applejack. Applejack is very dry and bright. And even though they both have similar fruitiness and the same alcohol content, like I get why calvados makes more sense in desserts, why we don't use it the same way as Applejack. And I would thoroughly, even if you're not a big drinking fan, I think calvados has some amazing culinary aspects that similar spirits do not.
Yeah, that sounds great. I want to try some Pummo now. That's like, just sipping on that sounds nice.
Yeah, I don't really think you have to do much else. But I will still I will still desecrate the Pummo on the video. Yes,
you'll do it for the podcast.
I will do it. Well, I tried some with some sherry. I won't lie, and I was like, oh, this is a nice angle though. Like there are ways that you can make it fun.
Ooh,
and
that's exciting. Yeah.
So don't worry. I'm not just desecrating a beautiful spirit for your benefit. It actually will result in a beautiful cocktail, I promise.
Sherry and Pummo. I did not think of that, but that sounds gorgeous.
I mean, sherry and apples is like a natural combo. Yeah. So, you know, it makes sense to me, but...
Yeah. Oh, that's just mouthwatering.
Yeah, right? So, yeah.
Awesome.
But, hey, we gotta... that is the end of our informative alcohol podcast as we've known it.
That's great.
Liz, well, I'm gonna give the floor to you now.
Great. Yeah, so we're gonna close the show today with a little announcement. There's gonna be some changes coming for Neat, and this is actually my last show. I've really enjoyed making Neat. I've learned so much over the last year. I'm just going to be refocusing on some other creative products. Not products. Projects. Ball. If you want to support what I'm working on now, you can check out Flat Pop Records on Instagram. I'll be working with them in the coming months. And I just want to say I sincerely, like, just thank you so much, Taylor, for this opportunity. I've really learned so much and really appreciated my time on here, and I just wish you the best.
I am so excited for everything you're gonna do moving forward, Liz, and this has been, you know, this wouldn't have happened without you. I fully, you know, respect that this is the next step for you, and I'm happy for you, but you will most certainly be missed. Not just by me, but by the audience that, you know, is here for you. So it's you know, it's last call on Neat as we know it.
But it's gonna change and it's gonna evolve, and I can't wait to see what you do with it next.
Yeah, I will still be here next week. I will have a super secret guest joining me. So you know, we'll have a little promo out later this week, but I really do I don't want to make it about what it's going to be. I'd rather have a moment to just respect what it has been. And this wouldn't have happened without you. And thank you so much.
Thanks, Taylor. And thanks everybody who has listened and joined us so far. And tune in next week for what's to come. And also join over on the video. Taylor's going to show you some really amazing cocktails as per usual. So you can find that on the YouTube page.
All right. I've been Taylor Smurl.
And I've been Liz June.
And this has been
Neat. Yay! Now pause my record.
Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shape the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisisCLE.com/podcast.